On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there, for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory. And his disciples believed in him.
Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Rob. I'm one of the pastors here, and it's great to see all of you. And what I want to do this morning is I want us to go back in time, and so you need to use your imaginations here for a moment. But I want us to just think about and imagine 5 men walking on a narrow and dusty road with their new leader. So these men, remember, they have left everything, their lucrative fishing business, their families, their livelihoods, to follow this guy they're calling Rabbi. And what's funny is that this rabbi looks more like a carpenter, rough hands, soiled hands, than a teacher of the religious law. But this week, they're on a journey, and things are changing, and now the teaching from this rabbi has begun. And I have to imagine that these men are wondering, gosh, where are we going on our first journey with Rabbi? Maybe they thought we're going to go to the temple to worship. Or maybe we're going to go to the synagogue to teach. Or we possibly might slip through the desert to the countryside and pray. And so they each had their own idea, I think. And so I wonder if it was Andrew who finally had the guts to say, "Hey, Rabbi, so where are you taking us? To the desert to pray?" And I imagine one of the other disciples saying, no, he's taking us to the temple for worship." And then I picture this argument breaking out between these early 5 first disciples. And I just imagine Jesus lifting his hand and saying, "Guys, we're actually on our way to a wedding." A wedding? Why in the world would we go to a wedding? I mean, the men must have thinking, well, Jesus, on our first journey, you're taking us to a party? I mean, don't we have work to do? I mean, don't we have people to heal? Aren't there messages that we need to teach? Aren't there a few Pharisees and teachers of the law that we need to rebuke and smack around a little bit, right? I mean, if we're honest, didn't Jesus didn't have a whole lot of time. He only had 3 years of public ministry. And how in the world could a wedding fit into his purposes on earth? Well, we're in this series in the Gospel of John. And John gives us an answer in chapter 2, the second verse. If you have a Bible, go ahead and turn there. If you don't have a Bible, the words should be on the screen. And John tells us that Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. And so, let me just ask, does this seem unusual to any of you that Jesus would attend a wedding? I mean, think about that for a moment. Because the truth is, all of us have different misconceptions of who Jesus was and what he came to do, right? I mean, would the Son of God really party all week long with common village folks at a really insignificant wedding. I mean, John never even tells us the name of the couple, right? That's kind of rude. But listen to what Max Lucado writes in one of his books. And it's a long quote, so forgive me, but I think it's really good. He says this: is this a big deal? I think so. I think it's significant that common folk in a little town enjoyed being with Jesus. I think it is noteworthy that the Almighty didn't act all high and mighty. The Holy One wasn't holier than thou. The one who knew it all wasn't a know-it-all. The one who made the stars didn't keep his head in them. He writes that Jesus was a likable fellow and that his disciples should be the same. And he says, I'm not talking about debauchery or drunkenness and adultery. I'm not endorsing compromise, coarseness, or obscenity. I'm simply crusading for the freedom to enjoy a good joke, enliven a dull party, and appreciate a fun evening. And here's the good paragraph. He says, we used to be good at it. What happened to us? What happened to clean joy and loud laughter? Is it our neckties that choke us? Is our diplomas on the wall that dignify us? Is it the pews, or in our case, these chairs that stiffen us? I must confess, he says, it's been a while. I love this. It's been a while since I've been accused of having too much fun. How about you? And here's what we're going to learn this morning. That Jesus loved to have fun. He enjoyed being around people. He enjoyed celebration. And if you're surprised by this, and I bet some of you are, I have some great news for you today. And so in this story that we just saw on the video monitor, John shows us not only that Jesus attended this wedding, but he actually kept the wedding feast from being a complete and dismal failure. And so to really appreciate what's happening here and appreciate the story, we actually need to go back in time and understand a little bit more about a Jewish wedding in the first century. Because when we read, oh, the wine ran out, they couldn't just run out to BevMo and buy more, right? So they couldn't make a quick little trip to the corner store either. And so in the village of Palestine, weddings were really important events. Actually, the entire town gathered and they were invited because you had to invite everybody. And the events of a wedding took place over an entire week. I mean, when my wife and I get invited to weddings, they're usually about 4 hours long. And then we try to slip out right after the cake cutting, right? Give me a cake, gone, right? Because we got to go pay the babysitters and everything else. But just think about this. Can you imagine going to a week-long wedding that was filled with dance and laughter and drinking and food? I could get used to that, right? That sounds awesome, you know? My wife and I were invited this past summer to some friends, and she was marrying a Palestinian. And I've never been to a Palestinian wedding before, and we were just guests, so I didn't have to do anything, which is kind of nice. After the ceremony, it was beautiful. We went and got our food, and I wasn't even halfway done with my meal, and all of a sudden, music starts playing, yeah, 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 and they start dancing. I'm like, shocked, right? And I'm like, I haven't eaten my food. And then Abby, one of our ladies, grabs me. Let me show you how to dance, you know. And I was like, whoa. And they told me, they said, Rob, in our weddings, dancing is everything. I'm like, really? And they, absolutely. And they went all night long. And it was awesome. And I remember telling my wife at the end, I said, hey, let's pray our kids marry a Palestinian. Because that was fun. I could get used to that, right? But they need to know the Lord, though. Okay, so... And so Jewish weddings during Jesus' day were, again, community-wide events. And here's the thing, hospitality was really important. And these families were under a considerable amount of pressure to really provide lavishly for all their guests, hundreds of them. And so you drank, you ate, you celebrated, you did this at the groom's house, you did this at the bride's house, you paraded down the streets. It was unbelievable. And so in that culture, though, if you were invited to this wedding, you didn't go down to Target and pick out a waffle maker and iron. You know, you wouldn't do that because really gift giving was really important. So you really had to select a gift that would honor the couple and their families. And here's the deal. The same is true for the host family. If the appropriate customs were not followed, not only would they be open to public shame and humiliation, but they could also get sued by the other families. Can you imagine that? Wine runs out and you get sued at your own wedding? Bad deal. That's what could have happened here. And so when the wine runs out, the host could have been embarrassed, could have been dishonored, could have been sued. So this was a crisis, right? Right? This was a huge deal. And so I don't know why Mary, the mother of Jesus, goes to Jesus to tell him about the problem. Maybe she was in on the planning details. Cana was only a few miles away from Nazareth. Maybe she was really tight with this family and she knew that this was going to be a big issue and an embarrassment. So she tried to interject. I don't know why. But she knows that her son could do something. I don't think she had in mind what he was going to do. And so she brings this problem to Jesus. All right. And as you saw in that video, Jesus is having a great time. And in case you're wondering, I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and say he was probably drinking wine too, okay? I know that may shock some of you. But then Jesus responds to his mom, and it looks kind of rude, kind of confusing. Look with me at verse 4 real quick. Jesus replies to his mom, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Now, in certain families, your mama might have slapped you if you talk like that, right? "Woman? Oh, I'll show you, woman." No, I don't know. Right? But in English, it does sound kind of harsh, kind of rude, like Jesus, like, "Don't you know your manners?" But really, this term in the original language was really just a formal way to address his mother, right? Later, we're going to see how he addressed the woman from Samaria, and then the woman who's caught in adultery. And then again, he addresses his mom much later when he's on the cross, and he says, "Woman." And so the best way I can describe this term, you know, I wasn't born in the South, even though some of you think I have a South accent, but a Southern accent. But it's kind of like the term "ma'am." You know, "Thanks, ma'am." Kind of like that, okay? That's kind of what this term is. And let's be honest. It is kind of unusual to talk to your mother this way. "Ma'am, why do you involve me?" But I think it points to something. See, Jesus is no longer under the watchful eye of his mom, right? His mother can no longer bend his ear about things that can distract Jesus from his purpose on earth. And so again, I don't think Mary knew that he was going to turn water into wine, because John says this is the first sign, the first miracle he's ever done. But he knew that Jesus could do something, right? And so she wants to help this family. She brings a really serious problem to the attention of her firstborn son. And what's interesting is that Mary was focused on the immediate problem. The wine has run out, right? But Jesus, in his response, shows us that he was focused on something else. He was focused on the cross. Look at the rest of verse 4. Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." If you read the Gospels, Jesus would answer people and they would kind of be confused. Like, "Wait, I just asked you a question. Now you're asking me a question. You just gave a story, a parable. What are you talking?" He had a way of drawing people in. He says, "My hour has not yet come." And the interesting thing about this, about the word "hour," it's often used in the Gospel of John, which we have been studying, to refer to Jesus' work on the cross, his death and his crucifixion. And so while Mary was concerned about this problem, Jesus saying, "Okay, that's a problem, but I have a bigger solution. Through my death, through my crucifixion on the cross, I'm going to give wine to all who come to me in faith and believe in me," right? And so Jesus was pointing to his work on the cross. He says, "My hour is not yet come." And so Mary, right, when the Son of God is your firstborn son, you kind of go, "Okay." And you go to the servant. She grabs the servant and says, "Hey, do whatever he tells you," right? That's a good response from mama. You know, "Hey, I don't know what he's going to do. Do whatever he tells you, because I don't know what's going to happen, but I know who can do something about it," right? And I want to stop, because that interaction should really encourage us this morning. You may not know what to do about a certain situation, but you know someone who does. If I was a black preacher right now, I would say, "Oh, y'all don't know what I'm talking about," and I'd walk away, right? T.D. Jakes does that. It's kind of funny. So let me just say that again so we're all connected here. You may not know what to do, but you know someone who does, right? And so, thank you. We will all, and here's the truth about life, we're all going to come across problems or a crisis or a circumstance that leaves us anxious, that leaves us indecisive, that leaves us even fearful. Guess what? That's just life. None of us are immune from those things. And so we can either choose to worry about it, which I know I'm really good at. We can choose to fix it ourselves, right? Or we can just kind of do nothing about it and hope it goes away, sweep it under the rug, hide. But John is telling us that there's another option. We can bring our problems to Jesus in prayer, and we can simply say, Lord, help me. I don't know what to do. The wine has run out. And I just want to say, Jesus really does care about every little thing that's going on in your life. And sometimes we think, oh, I don't want to bother him with that because, you know, it's not a big issue. If it's a big issue for you, it's a big issue for Jesus. Bring it to him. Bring it to him. All right, let's get back to the story. The story kind of takes a turn, and we begin to kind of understand its significance and meaning when Jesus, he tells the servants, hey, guys, go fill those 6 jars with water. And these were not just any water jars, okay? These were actually stone jars that were used for by Jews for ceremonial washings. And so here's what would happen. If you went to a wedding in ancient Israel and everyone was expected, especially if you were a Jew, to wash your hands every time you ate, right? And the Jews would actually use stone pots because instead of clay pots, because clay pots would get the water contaminated. So these were very specific jars, huge jars used for ceremonial washing. These jars had held about 20 to 30 gallons of water. All right, so it's really easy to do the math here. These puppies would soon be holding 120 to 180 gallons of wine. That is a sweet wedding gift. Can you imagine, right? Oh, what'd you get me? Oh, I got you 180 gallons of wine, Rob. Wow, thank you. That would be like incredible. And so the water, though, turned into wine, is then given to the master. He's kind of the guy in charge of the festivities and the food. And I don't think he even knows that there's a problem yet. And he takes a sip of the wine and is kind of, I picture his eyes lighting up, right? He's swirling the glass, you know? And as he tastes the body and the complexity and the tannins of this, the best wine he's ever tasted. And he's like, wow. And then look what he says in verse 10. This is great. He looks to the group and he says, hey, everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, right? And you're all like, yeah, we get that. We're cheap like that. And then look what he says. Oh, I love this line. He says, but you have saved the best till now. I love that. You have saved the best till now. And so John is not talking about being drunk. He's trying to emphasize the quality of this wine. And it is true that most wine back then was very diluted. You couldn't drink the water because, you know, you get sick, and so it was diluted. So for him to say this is really good wine is probably the modern day equivalent to what we drink today, for those of you who drink wine. And so he says, wow. John is emphasizing the quality, and watch this, and the timing of this wine. And so he's saying that anything served before this wine are inferior. And so it's all box wine before Jesus, John is saying, okay? But then he says the wine Jesus provides is far superior, as is everything that's tied to this new kingdom that he's creating, this new kingdom that he's ushering in that we're going to learn about, a lot more about as we go through the Gospel of John. And so here's the question. So what is this story all about, right? At the most basic level, this story reveals how the new wine Jesus brings surpasses the plain water of Judaism. Let me just explain that. The Jewish vessels of purification, these stone water pots, are now being filled with new things, better things, new wine. And so the wine that's already been served through the Jewish religion and through Jewish rituals is exhausted, and Jesus is replacing it with new wine. And so what's the principle? The principle is this. I think Jesus is talking about the difference between religion and the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, right? Religion and the gospel. See, religion This is true of religion in general. Religion, Jesus, what he does here, he changes the water of religion into the wine of his kingdom. And Jesus is saying that my kingdom is better, that my kingdom, it's more than just simply water. See, religion can't purify us from sin. See, religion can't make you look good. It can make you look good on the outside with its list of do's and don'ts. And it could wash the outside of your life, but it can't cleanse you deep within. See, only Jesus can heal the human heart. Someone once said it this way, and I think I shared this before. Religion is spelled D-O. It's what you do. It's being good. It's coming to church. It's standing up and sitting down. It's all these things. It's what you do. But Jesus says, no, a relationship with me is spelled D-O-N-E. It's what's been done for you, right? It's what Jesus did on the cross for you. Because guess what? You're never going to be good enough, right? And that's what separates Christianity from every world religion. Every world religion says, you better be good, and just maybe you'll make it. And Jesus says, you'll never be good enough. And that's why I came, and that's why I loved you. It's because it's been done. You can't prove your worth to me. You're my child. I've adopted you. You're in my family, you know? And so that's what he's saying here. But look at verse 11. John then kind of summarizes and then explains the significance of Jesus turning water into wine. He tells us exactly what this miracle means. Look at verse 11. He says what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs. If you're into circling your Bible, circle that word signs, through which he revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. Very important. He revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. And so John, who wrote this gospel, the beloved disciple, refers to Jesus's works. He calls them signs. Okay. And so in the first 11 chapters of John, they're actually called, this book is actually called the Book of Signs. And so John tells us this is the first sign of about seven signs and that Jesus will perform. And so what's a sign? Well, a sign points to something. A sign is supposed to tell us what to do. A sign is supposed to grab our attention. Like, for example, if I'm coming up to an intersection and there's a big red octagon, what should I do? Stop, right? Unless it's really late at night and no one's around, then you kind of go really slowly through it. But that's just my sinful nature, right? But you should stop. It's not a suggestion. It's a law, right? And that's what John is saying. John is saying Jesus's miracles are like signs. They point to something about his person and about his ministry. See, we need to remember that Jesus never does a miracle just to show off his power or to impress the masses of people. He wasn't interested in that. Every single miracle he did it to point people beyond the miracle to something and really someone much greater. And so John says these signs reveal that God is at work, that God is at present in the person of Jesus. That new wine is here and Jesus wants to come to him and drink from the fountain of life. And so in this miracle, in this sign, John tells us that Jesus reveals his glory and the disciples believed in him. So what does it mean? Like always, what does it mean to reveal God's glory? What is that all about? Like when we think of something glorious, when we think of glory, we usually think of something amazing, like the glory of winning the Super Bowl. Bad subject to bring up. I know. We're all tender and I know, depressed still. Right? But that's what we think about, the glory of doing that. But to understand a biblical definition of glory, we need to understand more of Jesus. And so John has already told us in chapter 1 that Jesus is not just a man. Jesus is not just a great prophet. Jesus is not just a great teacher. He is the Word, the Logos became flesh and who dwelt among us. In other words, in our language, the Bible says that Jesus is God. And so to know Jesus is to know God. To know God is to know Jesus. And so John tells us that Jesus reveals the presence of God and he radiates his light, his glory in a very, very dark world. Jesus reveals to the world God's glory. That's what he's getting at. But here's what's interesting about this story. not everyone recognized God's glory. See, in this story, the servants, they saw the sign, oh, cool miracle, but they didn't see the glory. See, it was actually the disciples who not only saw the sign, but by faith, they saw God's glory behind the sign, and their response was what? They believed in him. See, remember, Jesus did a lot of miracles during his time on earth, tons. And there are people who said, wow, you are God. That's amazing. I want to know you more. And other people who said, huh, that's a great little trick. Very interesting. And went back to their normal life. The same is true at this wedding. So even though the entire town gets to celebrate with this new wine, only a handful, only these five disciples and Mary saw the glory, God's glory behind the sign, and they believed in him. And they said, wow, this is not just some man. This is God in the flesh, right? And so not everyone recognized God's glory. Well, let's be honest here. I know you didn't come to church this morning to hear about ancient Jewish weddings, right? I get that. But I wanted to end with three applications, three things that you can take home and write down and start practicing on Monday. And here's the question I want to answer as we conclude. What do we do when the wine runs out in our own lives? What do we do when the wine runs out? Three things. First, when the wine runs out, this story tells us to bring the problem to Jesus, who provides abundantly for his people's needs. Bring the problem to Jesus. See, what strikes me about this story, and I was thinking about this, Jesus didn't have to do anything, right? This wouldn't be the first time or the last time wine ran out at a wedding. He didn't have to do anything. He didn't have to even be at the wedding, right? But what we see here is that is a person who cares deeply, not just about heavenly things, but about earthly problems as well, right? And if we're honest, it can be hard for us to understand a God who not only meets our needs, but a God who provides an abundance for us. And so I really look at this story, and man, this is a radical story about God's grace. And there is no measure and no limit to his grace. And there will always be enough grace to meet our every need. And so this story tells me that God is not just a God of the required. He's a God of abundance. Man, he fills those water pots all the way up to the brim. All the way up to the brim. And he didn't just put any kind of wine in there. He filled them with choice, Opus 1, Stag's Leap, Silver or Oak, Jordan type of wine. And 180 gallons of it. If you've never drank wine, I just listed off really five really expensive bottles of wine. Okay? And I love what John says. He says, and he saved the best for last. Right? So Jesus is the new wine. And so when you and I come to him in faith, he pours out his love and forgiveness into our own lives. And here's the thing. This story doesn't mean that he's going to provide for all your wants. But the story does say he'll provide for all your needs. Very big difference. See, this story doesn't mean that you're not going to struggle to pay your bills or that your health will always be on the up and up. Again, life is hard. There's no way around that. But when the wine runs out, John is telling us, man, we can go to the source of new wine. So whatever problems you have you run to the source of new wine? Second, when the wine runs out, this story tells us that we need to ask Jesus to fill us. We need to ask Jesus to fill us. See, this entire story, when you boil it down, I can give you one word of what this entire story is about. One word, joy. Joy. See, wine in the Old Testament, it's very interesting. Wine in the Old Testament was symbolic of joy and God's blessing. Read the Psalms, read the Proverbs. And then even at the Lord's Supper, when Jesus broke bread with his disciples, he told them, hey, guys, I'm not going to drink from the fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it again with you guys in our Father's kingdom. So he's pointing to his future. When he comes back again, he's saying, hey, guys, we're going to have a banquet and it's going to be incredible. And I'll drink wine with you guys then. And so to the Jewish people, we need to understand that wine symbolized joy. rabbis actually even had a saying about this. It goes like this. You might want to write this down. Great quote. They said, without wine, there is no joy. Without wine, there is no joy. And here's the danger of life. The danger in this life is that our wine can quickly run out. And for those of you who are here this morning, you may not have a relationship with Jesus Christ. I'm sure you're finding out that life can be empty. Life can be purposeless without him. And if you're like me when I was 17, you tried to fill your life with other things and you found out that you still didn't have joy. You might have had a little bit of happiness, but no joy. And even for those of us who are followers of Jesus, guess what? The wine can run out. Divorce, disease, a rebellious teenager, heartache and pain can quickly dry up the wine in our lives and it's gone. And it's a scary thing when the wine runs out, isn't it? And here's what I want us to see. You and I have no resource available within ourselves to replace the joy. No self-help book is going to work. You can't watch Oprah 100 times because she can't give you joy. John is telling us only new wine, only joy can come from Jesus Christ. You know, there's a great new children's book out. And if you have kids, you should get this book. It's called Thoughts to Make Your Heart Sing. The same author who wrote this little Bible we give to kids, Sally Lowe-Jones, and it's a great book, and I try to read it to my kids every now and then. And she had a great thing, and a great paragraph in there about joy. Let me just paraphrase it. She writes this, and remember, this is written to kids. She writes, when we make a big deal about God, when we glorify him, we are filled with joy. God created us so he could share his joy with us. Because he knows that it's the thing your heart needs most to be happy. When God says, glorify me, he's really saying, be filled with joy. I love that. God wants you to be filled with joy. God wants to fill you to the brim with joy. And so when we glorify him, when we make a big deal of God, when we worship him, when we pray to him, we are filled with joy. So let me just ask. Have you found joy in your life this morning? Has your life brought joy to others? Man, if you are out of wine this morning, or if the tank is low, ask Jesus to fill you back up to the brim. He will. He will. All right, one last thing. When the wine runs out, we need to remember that Jesus is still turning water into wine. See, there are some out there who would say, hey, miracles don't happen any longer, right? Those are for you weird religious folks. You know, it can all be explained by science and other things. Well, I'm a firm believer that Jesus is still in the business of doing miracles. I really am. But I think his greatest miracle doesn't happen on TV with the weird people with the weird hair, right? His greatest miracles, I think, happen every day when he transforms people into new creations. And follow me here. See, Jesus didn't just doctor up the wine to the water so it tasted kind of like wine, you know? He didn't do that. He transformed the water into the finest wine that people have ever tasted. And so the principle is really this. Jesus is not just going to doctor up your life a little bit, give you a little bit of a religion and then make you feel good a little bit. He's not going to put a Band-Aid on your needs. No, he wants to completely transform your life, just like he transformed water into wine. And so when you come to know Jesus, when you're captivated by him, when you begin to understand who he is, he gives you the power and he transforms you and changes you into the people he really wants you to be. Right? And so our lives, the Bible said, takes on a new nature. The old is gone. The new has come. That's the power of this story, that Jesus is still turning water, ordinary stuff, into wine, something extraordinary. And many of you could stand up and say, yeah, he's done that in my life, right? Right here. I was a mess. I was water, polluted water, you know? And God turned me into something amazing. And so let me just ask, like the disciples, do you see the sign? More importantly, do you see God's glory behind the sign? And are you ready to believe in Jesus and follow him all the way to the cross? That's what it means to be a disciple. Well, I want to end by just reading a great song I found this week. Chris August is a popular Christian artist, and he wrote this great song. It's called Water into Wine, and I think he gets this passage. Let me just read this, and then Tim's going to come out and lead us in a song. He writes, it's hard to read a song because you kind of want to sing it. You know, it's kind of weird. I won't sing. But he writes, I've been running around in circles, but I can't do this on my own. To be so far away from perfect, that's all I've ever known. It's not like I haven't been trying, because I've been trying every door. And when they open, I'd be lying on the floor because I'm always falling short. Anyone ever feel like that? And he said, I guess I thought it'd be easy because people always talk about peace. And now I'm picking up the pieces left of me because I see that it was you breaking me. And then the bridge says, I knew about the story revealing all your glory, how you can take nothing and turn it into something. But now I see my own life changing before my eyes because you saw me at my worst and you fulfilled my thirst like water into wine. And listen to this chorus. It's great. He says, I've been lost chasing dreams of yesterday, found my heart always leading me astray. So take these broken wings and teach them to fly because you're changing me from water into wine, from water into wine. Isn't that good? I wish I would have wrote it, you know?